with Jenna Ellis. I'm your host, Jenna Ellis, where we answer all of your questions, the burning questions you have, on demand. And this week, so many of you wrote in to ask for a deep dive into the Electoral College, especially following Governor Tim Walz, who is running, of course, on the Democratic ticket for vice president. His comments about the Electoral College, abolishing the Electoral College, and what do we think about this idea and moving toward a popular vote. So we're going to do a deep dive into the Electoral College today, and we have to go through the roadmap first of what is the Electoral College? What was the original purpose for which it was created as the mode of selecting our chief magistrate or our president of the United States? How has that changed, secondly, over the course of American history? And yes, it actually has changed. And then finally, what do we think about this question of either altering or abolishing the Electoral College? So first, let's get to the substance of Tim Walz's comments so that we can orient ourselves to the news cycle and why Tim Walz made these remarks. So this was at a little town hall that he was giving with supporters where he actually said that he wants to abolish the Electoral College. This is cut one.
Good point. Who's Tim Walz?
What is better, the Electoral College or the popular vote?
Oh my gosh, that's a great question. These are great questions. The teacher in me loves this. I've been asked to sign on, and a whole bunch of people signed on, and my good friend, I think Gene Green from Houston, was carrying the bill to get rid of the Electoral College. I'm thinking to myself, had Hillary Clinton won, probably none of them would have signed on to it. And so I'm really torn on this. I think any time, and I do believe the Constitution is a living document. I think Jefferson's quote about as mankind progressed and as technology progressed, the document was to progress with it, as how you deal with these things. But I do think you have to be very careful about some of those core principles. It always seems to me, going back to the Senate and the filibuster, the Electoral College seems very undemocratic to me. I mean, I think at first blush, but it also was an attempt to unify the less populated areas to try and give some voice. Now, those who would say this, the state of Wyoming has about 500 and some thousand people. They have less than in this congressional district. But the two senators from Wyoming have the same clout as the two senators from California. And the Electoral College system and how we divide that representative proportion is a challenge. So I don't have a concrete opinion on it right now. I do think it's incredibly uplifting to me to watch citizens thinking about it, to have us talking about this again. It makes us think that, again, the framers created something amazing. It's been amended over time. We may be at a point now where there's constitutional issues coming up, constitutional issues of conflict and things like that, that we may be called upon as citizens to try and solve. And that's what I got to hear feedback from all of you. It's that one especially. Again, if you're on the losing end of that, if you win the popular vote and lose the Electoral College, it's just maddening for people. But yes, sir.
Maddening for people, meaning Hillary Clinton, of course. But the Electoral College, he got a couple of things wrong there that we're going to go in depth in when we describe the Electoral College in terms of the apportionment of the electors. But there was a follow-up question from ABC to Governor Walz, and he, of course, retreated from that because he didn't want to tie Kamala Harris's full campaign to that position. This is what he said to ABC. Cut two.
I want to go back to something you said on Tuesday. You said, I think all of us know the Electoral College needs to go. But the campaign came out later that night, and they said that's not their stance. Yeah.
Well, it's not the campaign's position. And the point I'm trying to make is that there's folks that feel every vote must count in every state. Mm-hmm. And I think some of folks feel that's not the case. Our campaign does that. And the point I'm saying is I'm in five states in 2 days. We're out there making the case that the campaign's position is clear, that that's not their position. Their position and my position is to make sure that everybody understands their vote, no matter what state they're in, matters.
So that's something that you and Vice President Harris disagree on?
I have spoken about it in the past that she's been very clear on this, and the campaign and my position is the campaign's position.
My campaign is the campaign's position. What's the campaign's position? The campaign's position. So I think he got in a little of hot water about that. But this raised a national conversation about the Electoral College and does every vote actually count? And should that matter to our mode of selecting a chief magistrate or a president of the United States? So let's go back to history, to the Constitutional Convention. Now, remember, we were under a system of the Articles of Confederation, which had too loose of a federal government, a lot of state sovereignty, which I think we kind of actually need to get back to. And when we do an episode deep dive on federalism coming up, we're going to discuss more aspects of that. But when the colonies and the states sent the delegates to the Constitutional Convention, they were empowered with discussing and debating these ideas and ultimately creating a new chief rule or supreme law of the land that would govern America. And ultimately, they came up with the U.S. Constitution in its original form that was ratified by the states at that time. And so for people who say, you know, this was a runaway convention and the Constitution was a runaway and was illegal at its inception, they don't really understand the history here and the authorization of the delegates to the Constitutional Convention at that point in time. And so at the Constitutional Convention, there was, of course, a debate around this idea of a president and selecting a president. And so Alexander Hamilton, who was one of the founders and the chief three that wrote the Federalist Papers, which were the arguments and proponents and advocates for the ratification of the U.S. Constitution, the Anti-Federalists had arguments against. But for the Federalist Papers, there were arguments that were explaining to the states why to ratify the proposed Constitution. And Federalist number 68 is an essay of the Federalist Papers. It was written under the pseudonym Publius, which was the name under which all of the Federalist Papers were published. But this was likely written by Alexander Hamilton. And it was titled The Mode of Electing a President. And so there were different plans that were proposed at the Constitutional Convention for the method of selecting a president and trying to find a manner that would be acceptable to everybody who was represented, and whether this would be a method of the state executive casting their vote and ultimately the state executives then choosing the federal executive. That was one actually proposed plan by Elbridge Gerry, who proposed the selection by state executives or the governors. There was also the Virginia plan that was proposed by Governor Edmund Randolph of Virginia at that time, or possibly James Madison. The history is a little unclear on that, but it called for the selection of the executive by the national legislature or the Congress. So almost in a manner that right now our Congress selects a Speaker of the House, and the American public, our votes don't matter. And we've seen that, of course, in recent history with the GOP and their manner of selecting or removing their Speaker of the House. It's just by the body itself. So that was the Virginia plan. There was a New Jersey plan similar to the Virginia plan, but called instead for the possibility of a plural executive. And Alexander Hamilton initially actually supported a lifetime appointment for an executive similar to the judiciary, in addition to a couple of other ideas. And the term of 4 years was in the original Constitution, but it wasn't until later by constitutional amendment under Article 5 that we actually got term limits of 2 4-year terms for the chief executive. And so there were a lot of different views. And this is where, you know, lawyers love to debate things. And most of the founders and delegates to the Constitutional Convention were lawyers, and they understood that power has to contrast or conflict power, and they didn't want to centralize power into one individual elected office or one particular body. And we've seen in the display of the process of the U.S. Constitution that our federal government has gone so far beyond the original intention. And again, when we get to federalism and why state sovereignty matters, we'll go more in detail on that. But for the purpose of the Electoral College and this whole idea of how do we select a president, the president wasn't actually supposed to have nearly the amount of authority and power and attention that now in 2024 and beyond, it currently, that office currently holds, because the federal government as a whole was not supposed to have nearly as much power. And in fact, the specific delegated, enumerated, limited powers given to the federal government that are established in Article 1 to the legislative, Article 2 for the executive, and then Article 3 to the federal judiciary are very, very limited compared to the respective powers that are reserved to the states or to we the people and in a self-government mode. So this was a debate on how do we select our chief executive, and it really didn't necessarily occur to the founders to give a whole lot of weight to the representation specifically of the people and their popular vote as the central focus, because the federal government was originally intended to represent the states, and the states have their own executives, their own state legislatures that will respond more directly and more timely to the needs of the various states. And even what we're seeing now, I mean, with the recent hurricanes in Florida, for example, well, Florida and of course North Carolina, Tennessee, Georgia, they need more specific, adequate attention to particularized issues in real time than California does right now, or New York or Montana, right? And so what we're even seeing with the FEMA response from the federal government compared to what Governor DeSantis can do in more real time for the state of Florida is the perfect example of why the federal government just simply is not equipped to deal with the state's particularized issues on a local scale. So when we're talking about the United States engaging in war, when we're talking about issues of national sovereignty, when we're talking about issues that pertain to the composition of the United States as a whole, of course the federal government should be over those issues that should be similar and pertain to our border security, for example. Now, of course, states can of course protect their own borders, but that is part of the federal government's obligation and job, and that's why the issue of a uniform rule of immigration and naturalization is specifically enumerated and given to the state legislature to design, because it shouldn't matter whether you are coming from a different national sovereignty and you're immigrating to Florida or Texas or New York or California. That should be the same rule for anyone. That should not have a different method from state to state because it is a national issue. And we can see obvious justifications and legal rationale for that, because if it were a lot easier to immigrate to the state of California, and then once you become a U.S. citizen, or even you're just naturalized as a legal immigrant, and then you can move freely from state to state, then that just becomes the gateway that impacts all of the other states. And this is why border security, by the way, matters. So in terms of that delineation between what the federal government versus the state governments are responsible for, this is why the debate focused on the method for selecting a president, and does the president as the chief magistrate really represent the states or the individuals in the state? And that was the main focus around all of these different types of plans. And so in Federalist 68, Alexander Hamilton, likely under the name of Publius, talked about the mode of the appointment of the chief magistrate of the United States. And he says this, and we're kind of going to break this down a little bit, but this is a really important Federalist paper to understand why the Electoral College became the mode for selecting the chief magistrate under the original design of the Constitution. So he says this, and it's addressed to the people of the state of New York, because obviously he's a delegate, and it's saying, you know, this is why we're ratifying the Constitution. The mode of the appointment of the chief magistrate of the United States is almost the only part of the system of any consequence which has escaped without severe censure, or which has received the slightest mark of approbation from its opponents. The most plausible of these, who has appeared in print, has even deigned to admit that the election of the president is pretty well guarded. I venture somewhat further, and hesitate not to affirm, that if the manner of it be not perfect, it is at least excellent. So he's basically saying, like, listen, out of everything that we're debating, this is something that we all pretty much agree on. While it may not be perfect, it's at least excellent. So he goes on to say, it unites an eminent degree all the advantages, the union of which was to be wished for. It is desirable that the sense of the people should operate in the choice of a person to whom so important a trust was to be confided. This end will be answered by committing the right of making it not to any pre-established body, but to men chosen by the people for the special purpose and at that particular conjuncture. So he's talking about the electors themselves. And then he goes on to say, it is equally desirable that the immediate election should be made by men most capable of analyzing the qualities adapted to the station and acting under circumstances favorable to deliberation and to a judicious combination of all the reasons and inducements which were proper to govern their choice. So he's basically saying, and this is an argument against having the Congress or even the governors appoint their electors or become electors themselves, because he's saying, you know, they could be motivated by political advantage or by political reasons and inducements when we want electors that understand the trust that is given to a president. And so we want electors also, though, that understand this. And basically, this is a really good argument for having some qualification, at least in understanding the Constitution, for electors. Because as it stands in 2024, and we'll go through the history of this, electors have very minimal qualifications in the U.S. Constitution. And so often, a lot of these electors are only selected because they support the candidate that is running and have no real qualifications or by necessity otherwise. And so when you look at the U.S. Constitution in Article 2, Section 1, which is where we get the establishment and the requirement of the Electoral College, it says each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct. And we'll go back to that in a moment because that's very important. A number of electors equal to the whole number of senators and representatives to which the state may be entitled in the Congress, but no senator or representative or person holding an office of trust or profit under the United States shall be appointed an elector. So this language is what Alexander Hamilton is arguing for in Federalist 68 when he's saying, we don't want a senator or representative or person holding an office of trust or profit under the United States to be appointed an elector. Well, why? Because they could easily be influenced by whom they would ultimately select as an elector. And then, and so let's go back. So we'll pause that. We'll go back to Federalist 68. And he says, it is also peculiarly desirable to afford as little opportunity as possible to tumult and disorder. This evil was not least to be dreaded in the election of a magistrate who was to have so important an agency in the administration of the government as the President of the United States. But the precautions which have been so happily concerted in the system under consideration promise an effectual security against this mischief. The choice of several to form an immediate body of electors will be much less apt to convulse the community with any extraordinary or violent movements than the choice of one who was himself to be the final object of public wishes. And as the electors chosen in each state are to assemble and vote in the state which they are chosen, this detached and divided situation will expose them much less to heats and ferments which might be communicated from them to the people if they were all to be convened at one time in one place. So he's basically saying we need to do this state by state, right? And we want to make sure that this is divided as much as possible. We don't just want, you know, one place and one meeting where everybody can influence each other and then the states just become kind of this body of basically a body of direct democracy at this point, or mob rule, right? So then this is also very important in Federalist 68 in terms of the justification of the Electoral College. Nothing was more to be desired than that every practicable obstacle should be opposed to cabal, intrigue, and corruption. These most deadly adversaries of Republican government might naturally have been expected to make their approaches from more than one quarter, but chiefly from the desire in foreign powers to gain an improper ascendant in our councils. So basically, we don't want foreign influence. We don't want anybody else selecting our chief magistrate and our president other than our own people. Because why? This was supposed to be a government of the people, by the people, for the people. This is a representative republic with elements of democracy, but we wanted a detached method of choosing a chief magistrate with the least possible ways that the system could be corrupted, right? So they're thinking of all of these ways that we could have a president selected in a manner that doesn't truly have the best interests of we the people at heart. And so it goes on to, you know, talking about this and to talk about the executive being selected by this manner of the Electoral College. And so the U.S. Constitution talks about the electors then, and going back to Article 2, Section 1, the electors shall meet in their respective states and vote by ballot for two persons, one of whom at least shall not be an inhabitant of the same state with themselves. And then it goes on to talk about the process and procedure. And this is also where we get that the president and the vice president can't be from the same state. Well, why? Because then that would necessarily mean that concentrated power or attention might be given in preferential treatment to one state versus another. So again, they're trying to think of a way to make this the most fair to all of the states in the union. So going back to the original system of the Electoral College, this is basically a group of presidential electors that's formed every 4 years during the presidential election for the sole and only purpose of discharging their duty under Article 2 and voting for the president and vice president. So we do not have a direct popular vote. The popular vote is irrelevant to our method of selecting a president. And the number of electors in each state matters because how it was originally distributed, and still with the exception of adding three electoral delegates to the District of Columbia, which that was added later because there were a lot of lawsuits around it and DC thinks that it should become a state. And originally, if you go back in the Constitution, the District of Columbia was basically supposed to be the seat of power for the federal government that then did not have any sort of representation otherwise, so that the people in DC were not giving more power to the federal government than just what the seat of federal government was maintained to be. But anyway, they have three electoral votes now, and I don't think particularly that's a great idea. And I also think that the District of Columbia should not have been expanded. It should only literally be the seat of government, and that the land around that original plot that was given by the U.S. Constitution should be ceded back to Maryland and Virginia, not created into a new state. That would dispel all of the problems here, because then those people who live in the surrounding areas around the capital and the seat of federal power would then be part of a state and their vote would count, right? So that's actually the best solution. But the original distribution, and this is where Tim Walz gets it wrong, because remember in that response in his town hall that we played initially, he said that the two senators, you know, in Wyoming have just as much clout as the two in California. And what about the people? Well, okay, that's true for the Senate, but he's totally forgetting about the House of Representatives. He's forgetting about the 435 members of the U.S. House of Representatives that are specifically voted by popular vote so that they can represent the people. The Senate, in its original design, was not voted in by the popular vote, but the Senate was originally designed to represent the state legislatures and the state government itself, the legislatures and the governor, in the Congress. And that makes a lot of sense. And so originally, in the design of the Constitution, senators were appointed by the legislatures. And so the state, no matter how big its population, didn't matter, you get two. You get the same representation because every state is equal as a state under the Union. Makes a lot of sense. And this is why certain powers are delegated to the Senate rather than the House of Representatives, like, for example, advice and consent for judicial appointees, including the Supreme Court justices? Why do those appointments and nominees not go through the House of Representatives? Well, because it was supposed to matter to the states, and the U.S. senators were supposed to be accountable to their states and to the state governments. And if we still had that system with the appointment of U.S. senators by each state, we would have a very, very different composition of the Senate. And they would also act and behave very differently if they knew that they could be recalled at a moment's notice by their state. They would actually have to ask their state legislature, how do you want us to vote? They would be directly accountable, and they would be a representative of their state legislatures. But as it is now, nobody even thinks about state legislatures when we're talking about the federal government. And senators, U.S. senators, have so much more power than they were ever originally intended to. And that was modified, of course, by the 17th Amendment, which my opinion is that needs to be repealed. But so going back to the Electoral College count, so how the apportionment is allotted is that there currently are 538 Electoral College delegates, and it was originally 535. Before D.C. got their three, but originally it was to be the two U.S. senators. So each state would get two Electoral College delegates based on the two senators. And then the number that was added to that was based on the number of seats that each state had in the U.S. House of Representatives that would account for the population. And so that is dependent, of course, on the census. And that is implicit with a lot of problems because, of course, the left objected to the question on this last census in 2020 asking for citizenship. And of course, the census should only count U.S. citizens because U.S. citizens are the only ones that can vote in U.S. elections and the only ones that should be represented in the United States House of Representatives and in the Electoral College. So the census actually matters to the composition of how many delegates from each state go to the Electoral College. So currently, and in its original form before the District of Columbia was added, we have 535, now 538 delegates that are allotted to the states based on population and also their U.S. Senate. So there is an account in the Electoral College math of the population density of the state. This is why California has 54 delegates, Texas has 40, and Florida has 30, and my former home state of Colorado only has 10. Wyoming only has 3. Montana only has 4. But that's okay because two senators per state, so two delegates, but then apportioned based on the population. So we're already accounting for basically the popular vote, or at least the popular will of the people, and that element of democracy that's embedded into the Electoral College. But you have a little bit of distance from just the popular vote so that the concentration of the population for the popular vote is not just in California, Texas, Florida, and New York, and nobody would care about what Wyoming or Colorado or Montana thinks if we went sheerly by the Electoral College. So you can see how this particular distribution of Electoral College math is actually intended specifically to account for state sovereignty, but then also the elements of direct democracy and the people. And so the Electoral College was a brilliant idea. All right, so now that we understand the Electoral College math and how it's actually designed to be detached from direct democracy, will of the people, the popular vote, and yet still take that into account, the method of choosing electors can also be modified pursuant to the U.S. Constitution in Article 2, Section 1. So remember I said let's go back to that one clause? Let me read this again. So it says, each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct. So may, when we're talking about legal documents, may means it's permissive. Must is should, and it's an imperative. So as the legislature thereof may direct, so they have some discretion in the manner of appointing their electors. And so the method and manner of appointing electors is a very interesting history, because originally, in its inception, most states, before about 1824, most states had their electors selected by the legislatures of the states. And so even though there was a representative element in the math of the people and also the Senate, the state legislatures were supposed to represent the will of the people. And so the people could petition and appeal to their legislature. But because the United States president was supposed to be so far removed from the individual, I mean, we see all of the campaigns today saying, oh, we're representing the will of the American people. We care about the people, the people, the people. Well, really, the United States president is supposed to represent the states and the union as a whole. And we're entirely forgetting in 2024 and beyond that the whole purpose of the federal government is just for sake of the union and to represent the states themselves and state sovereignty, which then in turn represent the will of the people. And so originally, state legislature said, well, we are going to appoint our electors based on, you know, input from our representative constituents, but we are going to decide for the states what electors we want to send and bind them in their vote to selecting a chief magistrate. And then in 1824, some of this legislation changed, and the majority of states after that decided to have either by district or by popular vote at large. So there's popular vote districting and then popular vote at large. To have popular vote at large or by districting select the electors. And that's where we're still at today, where the almost all states have popular vote and at large for their selection of their electors. And this is where we get to this idea that now the Electoral College needs to be abolished, because it only matters what the popular vote based on the at large. It's not even by district anymore. I mean, that's not the Democrats' argument. They just want the popular vote at large to determine the chief executive. So do you see through this explanation of the purpose and the design and the math of the Electoral College and its inception, how the argument for abolishing it is going directly from the at-large will of the people to the president? It's jumping over the state legislatures, the state executives, the Congress, and the calculation and the apportionment directly to the president. And that shouldn't happen. That's not something that our system was designed for, to have the direct will of the people and the popular vote at large determine the president. Why? We can see that in the math, because then the highest populated dense areas in states like California and Texas and Florida and New York would determine in every election who our chief magistrate is. And you may think, well, so what? Because that's still representative of the will of 50% plus one of the American people. Why does that matter? Well, it matters because the people in those states are governed very differently and have very different models and state issues and things that matter to them than the rest of the country. California isn't too concerned about hurricanes, and Florida isn't too concerned about earthquakes, and New York isn't too concerned about, you know, sunshine in January, and Florida isn't too concerned about snow in the middle of summer, right? I mean, all of these things that are very different based on the composition of the states matter to states differently. And so a chief executive would then be beholden and likely over advantage and over consider the citizens of just those couple of handful of states that the highest population density controls. That's why I think Alexander Hamilton and the rest of the founders that ultimately ratified the Electoral College as the method for choosing our chief executive were brilliant, because they embedded all of these aspects of hearing from the people, but being ultimately beholden to a distinct and separate body that should not be as influenceable and disposed to corruption or foreign influence. They can't be part of the federal government and trust already, so that they can't be corrupted by political influence. I mean, this was a brilliant design. And so I also think it was actually a mistake to have the popular vote at large, or even popular vote by district, be the main method of choosing the electors. Because this is why people like Kamala Harris, for example, and even Donald Trump can go and make all kinds of campaign promises and say whatever they want to the so-called low information voters on both sides, right? And the people who barely pay attention to politics have a direct say in the choosing of our chief executive. I think, and I believe, looking at the history and then also what has come over the last 250 years of selecting a chief executive, we should return back to the state legislatures, hearing from the people, but ultimately casting their vote for the electors. Because then, imagine if Kamala Harris and Donald Trump in this election had to go to each individual state legislature and talk to those representatives and say, hey, what is going on in your state that you are directly hearing from your people? What bills have you passed in your state? I mean, these people, none of the federal campaigns care about that. And I know, I've worked on them on the presidential level. They're not concerned with what the state legislature is passing. They bypass that all the time. I mean, I have people who, friends, who are elected representatives in various states. They can barely get a hold of anyone in Congress. I mean, even now with Amendment 4, which all of you have heard about in my now home state of Florida on abortion regulation and trying to cement that that so-called right into the state constitution, Governor DeSantis's office has even had a really hard time as the governor getting a hold of Florida members of Congress who are Republicans, so on the same side as his own party, and having them care and invest and participate in opposing Amendment 4. Why? Because they're too concerned about Congress. And they know, they don't need to even care what the governor says. They're in the federal Congress, right? And so because they are directly elected by the people, and because the Florida senators, so, Rick Scott and Marco Rubio, neither of them have up to this point said a word about Amendment 4. And they don't have to, because they are directly popularly elected out of the state of Florida. Imagine if they were beholden to the Florida state legislature that is very heavily influenced by Governor DeSantis. They would be singing a different tune right now. They would be participating in what matters to the state of Florida, not just their, national media hits and basically being a senator for all Americans. That's basically what it's come down to. A lot of people, you don't even remember that Jim Jordan is from the state of Ohio. You don't really remember, that Kamala Harris was from California, because it doesn't matter anymore when we're talking about the federal government. And so when we're talking about the Electoral College, it has started to not matter the composition of the U.S. Congress, or especially the state legislatures and the state executive. And that is a huge mistake. So with that history, and I think it's very fascinating if you look at the alternative methods of choosing electors and the legislation on the state level that has delegated that power to a popular vote at large, that the state legislatures who are talking about, and most of them are Republican states, who are talking about a return to state sovereignty and federalism, not actually considering maybe changing their method of selecting electors back to their state legislatures. I think it would be a brilliant move if every red state said, we are going to change that method based on the U.S. Constitution and the power that Article 2, Section 1 gives us. And of course, the Democrats and anybody, welcome to all the haters who are listening to this podcast, by the way, we always love having you. Everyone, would say, oh, this is a disenfranchisement. This is something where, you're taking away the will of the people. That's just simply not accurate. That's not true, because we already have a method by which the people can cast their vote in elections that they are able to participate in. And there is no guarantee in the U.S. Constitution. And in fact, there is a power distribution otherwise that says that the state legislatures can choose their electors if that is the legislation that the state so implements. And so it's not a disenfranchisement, and the Electoral College is certainly not a disenfranchisement, because that's the going narrative that Tim Walz and other people are advocating. The left, who would like to abolish the Electoral College, is saying that because it's not the popular vote, the will of the people is disenfranchised. I hope with this further deep dive and understanding of the Electoral College, you are now recognizing the absurdity of that argument. Because a national popular vote would actually disenfranchise everybody who doesn't live in either California, Texas, Florida, or New York. So it's an absurd argument, but because it's called popular vote and you say, hey, we want every vote to count equally, then the Democrats are relying on conservatives not having a clear understanding of why the Electoral College was established to begin with. So we need to be very clear about what our Constitution says, why the Electoral College was established, the history of the Electoral College, and I think we actually need to be very bold at suggesting in state legislatures methods of ensuring that actually our vote and our electors count and matter in terms of our method of choosing the chief magistrate in a way that is not influenced by low information voters. So that's our deep dive on demand today for our method of choosing electors and the Electoral College. If you have a topic or idea that you would love a deep dive and further education on for on demand, then you can always reach me and my team, Jenna, at afr.net. And I will see you next week for another issue on demand.